What real number six? Mr. Bolt, between 1911 and 1912, during a period of about 2 years, the name of this flying service was changed on three occasions. It changed from the Balloon Section of the Royal Engineers,
yes,
to the Air Battalion, and finally to the Royal Flying Corps. Could you tell me whether these changes in title had any effect upon you personally?
There was no difference in the work we did from the Balloon Section until the Flying Corps was formed. The Balloon Section and the Air Battalion carried on exactly the same. The only difference was that February 1911, we became the Air Battalion Royal Engineers instead of the Balloon Section Royal Engineers.
Now, you said that there were some changes when the Air Battalion became the Royal Flying Corps. What were these changes as far as they affected you personally?
The Flying Corps formed in 1912. Later on, when the Naval Air Service took over the balloons and airships, we had the option of remaining with the Royal Flying Corps military wing or transferring to the RNAS. Most of us remained with the Flying Corps military wing. All the others became RNAS.
Now, at that stage, when you elected to stay in the Royal Flying Corps or to stay in the military wing, how was your work, how were your duties affected by the loss of the airships? Exactly what did you do from that point on?
Well, when we handed over the airships to the Navy, airships and balloons to the Navy, we became number one squadron, Royal Flying Corps. That was airships, balloons, kites, and repair work for the two or three machines we had on Jersey Brow. That we became known.
So you'd actually lost the airships and the balloons,
yes,
at this stage, yes.
And we remained aircraft park, number one aircraft park, which was number one squadron.
Now, you went to France right at the outbreak of war in August 1914 with the aircraft park. Could you tell me something about your arrival in France and your journey to Saint-Omer, where you were based?
When we went to France at aircraft park, we took with us lorries, repair shops, which was a large lorry fitted out as a workshop. We had the wireless and telephone lorry, which fitted out for wireless and telephone calls. We had one or two spare engines, but not many, that we took with us from England to France. We 4 days held up outside Boulogne Harbour.
Can I just ask you what the total size of the party was then? How many lorries, how many other men? The men marched,
well,
didn't
the
they?
Old squadron of about, I think, 200 to 250 strong.
Yes. How many lorries did you have? About?
I should think 12 or 14 lorries completed the whole of the transport.
So it was a pretty big convoy then,
yes,
wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
And you'd have, what, about 200? About 200 of the party would have marched all the way?
Yes, yes.
What do you remember of the journey from Boulogne?
From Boulogne, we marched to a camp on one of the hills at Boulogne. On the way, quite a number of people fell out. One was found to be carrying 24 tins of bully beef in his haversack, which he was placed under arrest for.
This is why he had to drop out of the march, his load was so heavy.
He had to drop out because he couldn't stick the pace,
yes,
the march. I don't know what the French people thought of this lot as the British army, but we had two officers. One, Captain Carden, who had one arm, the other, Captain Brabazon, who had to walk with the help of the stick because he was partially lame. The other officers would have gone by separate transport to the station, the camp. We stayed the one night at the camp, and 4 o'clock the next morning we went to Juvisy, which was a few miles from Paris. We were there for a very short time and then went to Saint-Omer, which was the aircraft park depot for the Isle of France.
Could you describe for me the kind of work which you personally were doing at Saint-Omer in the aircraft park during this first 6 months of the war?
Well, during the first 6 months of the war at Saint-Omer, I was employed as a rigger. We were heavily overworked with machines coming through for repairs from squadrons with some landing faults, others to put in better flying conditions, we were working day and night to get machines serviceable. We had two or three test pilots at Saint-Omer, including Gordon Bell, who used to test the Martinsides and Sopwith Scouts, the smaller machines.
The faults that you were having to deal with at this time, what were the most common ones?
The most common fault was repairs to the landing gear,
yeah,
of the machines, because quite a number had been shot up, some of the struts had gone, the landing wires had been shot through and grazed, and the steering wires to the rudder. And planes having to be repaired, some struts with struts damaged, the canvas covering been repaired through some, in some cases, very big holes, which the planes had to be completely repaired. Before being attached to the machine again.
Did you gain any appreciation of what the sort of rate of damage to aircraft were? I mean, were they lasting very long, or were they having to come in quite frequently?
Oh, they were coming in, the machines were coming in every day for repairs of different kinds.
Did the aircraft park at Saint-Omer grow in size very much during this period?
Oh, they were getting people from home.
How many did you start with, and how did it grow during this period?
Well, it started with about 250, and I should think when I left, aircraft park must have been at least 300 or 400 strong. Because we had to have further living quarters at Lumness, which was by the headquarters. At Saint-Omer, all riggers had to conform to what was then known as the trenchard splice. The trenchard splice was different in that it had four tucks to the splice instead of three previously used. What I mean by tuck is one wire been placed under the other wire and drawn through.
Like a sort of half hitch?
Yes.
Yeah.
You had four splices and then twined around the finish of the splice was twined around, tightened up with a bit of string so that you wouldn't cut your fingers when touching the splice with your hand.
And Trenchard insisted you should have four, did he?
Yes, Trenchard insists on four. And he could do splices himself, that he knew what he was talking about when referring to splicing. Salmon.
Tell me what kind of impression Trenchard made on you as a man.
Well, a strict disciplinarian. He was always smart in dress himself and always wanted for other people, men, to be smartly dressed. I've known him when the top agent as a CO. I've known him to get up in a tree just before reveille when he wanted early calls by the order sergeant, and is called to the sergeant when he is called, say, "What do you want?" "Well, I'm the order sergeant, sir." "I ordered you to call me at, you know, whatever time, 5 o'clock. It's now 6:20. Is this what you call early call?" and send him, you know, tick him off. Wouldn't put him on a chart, but tick him off.
Now, when you went back to England, you went to Shoreham, joined up with 14 Squadron for a while, and while you were there, I believe the Duke of York was your flight commander. Can you tell me anything that you remember about him?
Whilst I was at Shoreham, the Duke of York was my flight commander. He went for a flight in a Morris Farman, Longhorn. Landing, he landed on the wrong side of the border, aerodrome border wire, on the Worthing side. He came walking back, and squadron leader Barry Martin, who was the squadron leader of that squadron, a 14th squadron, said, "Well, you bloody fool, do you think that machine is going to walk back?"